Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 2006, Christine Pelosek broke the story of a terrifying serial killer who went unchecked in Los Angeles for decades. 2 years later, in a cover article for LA Weekly, Pelosek dubbed him the Grim Sleeper for his long break between murders. The killer preyed on a community devastated by crime and drugs and left behind a trail of bodies, all women of color, all murdered in a similar fashion, and all discarded in the alleys of Los Angeles. The case of the Grim Sleeper is unforgettably singular, but also tells a wider story about homicide investigations in areas beset by poverty, gang violence, and despair, about how a serial killer could continue his grisly work for 2 decades, in part due to society's lack of concern for his chosen victims, and about the power and tenacity of those women's families and the detectives who refused to let the case grow cold. No one knows this story better than Pelosek, the reporter who followed it for more than 10 years. Based on extensive interviews, reportage, and information never released to the public, The Grim Sleeper captures the long, bumpy road to justice in one of the most startling true crime stories of our generation. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Grim Sleeper, The Lost Women of South Central, with my special guest, journalist and author Christine Pelosek. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Christine Pelosek.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much for joining me. This is congratulations on, as I mentioned in the introduction, 10 years of some incredible journalism. Congratulations. Let's start right into this, because this is an incredible involved tale, and of course, as we mentioned, covering 20 years. So let's start, as you do in your book, when you're speaking with Coroner Assistant Chief Winter, and you are a crime reporter for the LA Weekly, an alternative newspaper. Tell us a little bit about your relationship with Chief Winter and what you were doing there in January 2006 and your very, very interesting conversation.
Sure. I regularly went to see him, you know, maybe once, twice a week, because I was a crime reporter at the LA Weekly at the time, and I was always looking for stories to cover. And so I had been, you know, dropping by his office, you know, once, twice a week for, you know, a year or two. And on that particular occasion when I went, he told me that his office was looking into a series of body dumps of women that were found in LA County, and it was between the years 2002 and 2006, and the women were found in alleys, dumpsters, all over LA County, and there were 38 women, and they were, you know, mixture of white women, African-American women, Hispanic women, and their coroner's investigators had gone to the death scenes and had noticed, you know, there were so many of these women, so they decided to put this task force together to look into it. But he told me that, you know, there's so many cases at the coroner's office, so they couldn't spend all their time doing it. So they only dedicated, you know, whenever they had a free moment, to look into the cases to see if any of the cases were linked. And so he told me that, and I asked him at the time whether I could get the list and look into it, and he said no. And so it went on for months and months and months before he finally actually gave me this list. And so I started looking into it to see if I could see any connections. And one of the things for him is that they tried to reach out to the law enforcement agencies, you know, LA County Sheriff and, you know, all the law enforcement agencies around LA, LAPD, et cetera. And, you know, they didn't really want to pay attention to the coroner, you know, because it's really the coroner's there to, you know, figure out the cause of death, whereas the LAPD detectives and LA County Sheriff, they actually try to solve the cases. And so they didn't really want the coroner involved in their, you know, in their cases. So he ended up giving me this list. And from there, I ended up contacting all the different law enforcement agencies that were involved. There was a number of them. And I found that some of the cases weren't actually even homicides. Other ones, the case that had been solved, it was like a guy had killed his girlfriend, or, you know, it was a girl who, you know, was a drug overdose or something along those lines. But there were a lot of murders, and the bulk of them were murders of African-American women in South Los Angeles. And so as I was going through and investigating, I came across a case. It was like the 37th case on the list, and it was a girl named Princess Berthemieu. She was a 15-year-old runaway out of Inglewood, which is a city sort of just next to Los Angeles and near the LA airport. And so I ended up talking to the detective there. It took me a while before I actually was able to get a hold of him. And when I did, he actually told me that Princess's case was linked through DNA to a case in Princess's case, by the way, was 2002, and her case was linked to a woman by the name of Valerie McCorvey, who was killed in South Los Angeles in 2003. She was a 35-year-old mother of two, and she was found dead in an alleyway. And he had told me that those two cases were linked to a series of murders that happened in South Los Angeles back in the 80s, and the killer had shot his victims with a 25 caliber gun to the chest. And so all the cases were linked. Well, the 80s cases were linked through ballistics to a 25 caliber. And those cases in the 80s, there was seven of them, were linked through DNA to Princess's case and Valerie McCorvey's case. And so that's how I ended up finding out about it.
You talk about the one survivor that you knew at that time. And her name was Anitra Washington, and she was shot, raped, and left for dead. Tell us a little bit more about this Southside Slayer Task Force. And we can't get into all the missteps, or we don't say missteps, but false leads and all the other people that were looked at and investigated in terms of no avail. So let's talk about a little bit about that Southside Slayer Task Force.
Okay, well, back in the 80s, there was a lot of women getting murdered. I mean, at the time, there was a huge crack epidemic all over the U.S., you know, mostly in the big cities, and L.A. was one of the cities that was just, you know, destroyed by the crack epidemic, as well as, like, gang warfare, and, you know, there was just a lot of drug dealing, et cetera, going on back in the 80s, and there was a lot of women getting murdered. You know, over that decade, there was hundreds of African-American women that were found dead. And at the time, the police, they started looking into the murders back in 1984. And they actually thought it was the work of one killer. And so they actually dubbed this, they started a task force, and they called it the Southside Slayer Task Force. And they called the alleged killer the Southside Slayer. And they thought that it was one person responsible for all these murders of women in South Los Angeles. But it turned out that it was more than one killer. There was actually six serial killers operating at the same time in South Los Angeles. And so, but at first, you know, they thought it was this one guy, even though like the ways that the women died were different. Like some, like the Grim Sleeper killer, he shot his, you know, shot the women in the chest, whereas some of the other women were strangled, other ones were stabbed. So why they thought that the cases were linked, I don't know. I'm thinking because they didn't really know a lot about serial killers at the time, even though there were, you know, Richard Ramirez was, you know, active in 1985, you know, so there were some serial killers like Hillside Strangler and things along those lines. But you know, so for whatever reason, they thought it was one. But as they got this task force together, and they had like 40 or 50 detectives, you know, working from LA County Sheriff and LAPD, and they realized that there was actually more than one killer. And they actually did. They were able to catch two, you know, back in the 80s. And the other ones weren't caught until the LAPD started its cold case unit in the early 2000s. And then, you know, a few other serial killers were unearthed because of it, including Lonnie Franklin Jr., the Grim Sleeper.
You talk about in the book, and I think this is very important to why you were so persistent and why you were so important to this investigation and this story, and hence the book. Tell us a little bit, as you do in the book, about your background living in Ottawa, Canada, and your reaction when you came to Los Angeles and some of the things that you saw. What was your overall reaction and impression?
Well, I mean, I came from Ottawa, which, you know, there's not very many murders in Ottawa. So when I moved to Los Angeles, I was kind of surprised just how many murders there were and just how little, you know, the media and people knew about them. I mean, in Ottawa, if you had a murder, I mean, everybody knew it was on the front page of the newspapers. Whereas here, you know, so many people were getting killed and really no one knew about them. And I just found that like extremely tragic. And in this case with the women, I mean, there was barely, you know, except for the families, like they were really the only ones that seemed to care at the fact that these women were killed. I mean, back in the 80s, I mean, there was coverage for sure of it, but I mean, we didn't know who these women were. And, you know, when you compare it to some of the cases out there, you know, when you had like Natalie Holloway, I mean, everybody knows who Natalie Holloway is and what happened to Natalie Holloway. But, you know, with these women, no one knew about them. And so I really wanted to find out more about the case. Number one, I wanted to, you know, I was hoping that the case would be solved, but I also wanted to give the women a voice and let people know who they were. And they weren't just, you know, discarded, like, you know, Lonnie discarded his victims like trash. And, you know, I wanted people to know who they were. So that's kind of, you know, part of the reason why I, you know, got involved with it.
You also talk about the main focus of this is South Central, and you talk about the incredible amount of murders in Los Angeles, but you say over half of those occur in this much, much smaller area, comparatively South Central. So tell us a little bit about South Central and the characteristics of it for those people that don't know before we talk about Deborah Jackson.
Sure. South Los Angeles is a community sort of just not too far away from downtown Los Angeles. And it was back in the 80s. It was predominantly African-American, you know, middle, lower class, you know, lower income families. And at the time when these serial killers were actually working in Los Angeles, like they were working within like a 51 square mile area. And they were sort of all hunting the same spot. And this place, you know, in the 80s, I mean, it was just ravaged by crack cocaine, drive-by shootings. It was the start of gangs. So a lot of the gangs, like the Bloods and the Crips and all of them were, you know, beginning, at, you know, around that time and, you know, causing, you know, huge disturbances and killing people. You know, so at the time, it was like a very, very, like, violent place. And, you know, so it made it sort of easy for a serial killer to work and not get caught because the police were so focused on, you know, trying to stop like the gangs and, you know, the drive-by shootings and the drug war that they weren't really paying attention to the serial killers that were killing women and dumping their bodies in these alleys.
Now you talk about Deborah Jackson. And she has three children, and she had her first child at 14. And so you talk about this tragic life, but you get to know everybody here, and you get the incredible access to these people. So you not only put a face on it, but really an incredible story behind from the information you gather. Tell us a little bit about Deborah Jackson.
Well, Deborah was the first known victim of the Grim Sleeper. She was a cocktail waitress and lived with her girlfriend in South Los Angeles. And, you know, she had three kids when she was quite young. and had moved out to Los Angeles because of her grandmother was living out here. And so she moved out, and she actually worked in the, she was actually like a hairdresser, and she did braids and things like that. And then she ended up getting a job at a nightclub in Inglewood. And so, you know, she worked, you know, nights, and she had lost her kids for, I guess she had lost them for a few years. She had issues with drugs. And so the kids were in foster care. But at the time of her death, she was actually trying to get her kids back and was like within days of reuniting with her children when she was murdered. And she was at a friend's house, and then she left to go back to her place. Her and her girlfriend at the time got into a fight. And so she ended up staying the night over at her really good friend's house. And then she was going back to her old apartment, to a neighbor's house, to give this woman $20 that she owed her, and she never made it back. And so the police suspect that she was probably hitchhiking, and then she was picked up by Lonnie Franklin, and then he killed her, and then, you know, tossed her body in an alleyway.
Now, it's interesting, too, that the police, of course, follow up every lead, but very early on, and not to beat up on police or anything, but it's just the story of what happens with her friend Beatrice and how they treat her with this death, this former really good friend.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, they thought Beatrice was the killer, you know what I mean? Because, I mean, in cases where you have, you know, they always look for murders, you know, you always look at the person, you know, that, you know, like whoever they're dating or, you know, husband to wife. And so,
sure.
You know, she was suspect, you know, she was suspect number one. And I mean, they thought it was her up until the time that Henrietta Wright was killed, like a year later. I mean, you know, they looked at, you know, Beatrice and, you know, figured it was her. And I mean, you know, they grilled her and all this other stuff and thought she was lying and the whole nine yards. And so they were fixated on it, you know, and looked for the gun, you know, because they knew she was killed by a 25 caliber. They weren't able to find a gun, but she was like the prime suspect. And it really wasn't until Henrietta was killed that they thought, oh, geez, maybe it was, you know, maybe it's not her. And so they moved on. And then at that point, when Henrietta Wright was murdered, a woman came out of the woodwork and basically said that it was her boyfriend who was responsible. And so then they completely focused on that, you know. So, I mean, it was a lot. I was talking to a detective, and he was telling me that, I talked to a couple of detectives, but this one guy in particular had said that, you know, back, you know, when they were working, like it was 77th Division LAPD station that was handling, you know, the bulk of these murders. And I mean, there was like eight detectives handling like 130, 140 cases. And, you know, on the weekend, they'd have two detectives working, you know, four, five, six, seven, you know, sometimes eight cases. So they'd work on something for 24 hours if they were lucky, and then they'd get another case that they'd have to work on. So they never had time. Like, they hardly had time to follow up. And when they did have time to follow up, it could be, like, weeks later, you know, when everything had gone cold, you know. So they were having a hard time. And then they were saying that the Parker Center, which was kind of police headquarters, they weren't getting a lot of support from them, you know. So they were kind of doing it on their own. And, you know, they worked, you know, 24 hours a day sometimes, but it just wasn't enough. And the money, you know, that Parker Center, like headquarters, was getting was not going to South Los Angeles, you know, so it was a huge issue,
yeah.
You know, and it didn't matter if the homicide detectives actually wanted to solve the cases. They just, there weren't the resources. And one detective told me, he was like, half the time he didn't even have, like, we'd rush around and he'd make these little notes, but they do these investigative reports. You're supposed to have, like, you know, when there's a homicide, you're supposed to have these investigative reports and put everything in, like everybody you interviewed and whatever. And you're supposed to do it in a timely manner. So, you know, so the next person who looks at the case will have the notes and whatever. And some of these detectives were telling me that sometimes it would take weeks before they'd actually write these investigative reports, you know, and they'd have to do it from memory and they'd forget details. And, you know, so it was a real mess. And it made
yeah.
it, you know, solving these cases really hard. And I think that when somebody would turn around and say, hey, so-and-so did it, I think they jumped on it, you know? And,
yeah.
you know, that's what they did in some of the cases, unfortunately, you know? So, you know, there was people that were arrested when they had nothing to do with it. And, you know, As you know, there was one case. There was an L.A. County sheriff they believed was responsible, you know, because they found a 9mm in his car, not a 25 caliber, but a 9mm. And, you know, he was charged. And it wasn't until ballistics, you know, basically exonerated him that, you know, but even, you know, years later, people still believe that he had something to do with it. You know, and it turned out, you know, he died in 2003, sort of in between Princess and Valerie. And, you know, it was impossible for him to be the killer unless he was killing from the grave. So, you know, it was pretty, it was really hard. So it was a real combination of things going on, you know, factors, you know, going on back then that made it very difficult to solve these cases.
Yeah, very understandable. Wild goose chases, like you just mentioned, that you write in the book, where it seems like that they've got a really good, reasonable suspect here based on circumstantial evidence. So, and it leads to nothing. You talked about Henrietta Wright. She was 34, mother of five, and she was found in August 1986 in an alley. Tell us, they do a link. They say in the same 25 caliber gun is used to kill Deborah Jackson. What else was similar, the similar methodology or signature that was left at that crime scene?
Well, I mean, they were all found, like they were, she, you know, both of them were shot with a 25 caliber. Both of them were shot with, the gun was close range, you know, was almost a contact wound.
Right.
And all his victims were pretty much, you know, had clothes on. Some of them had, you know, shirts pulled up or pants pulled down kind of thing. But I mean, all of them were found in the alleyways, you know, all of them were found, you know, within a few miles of each other. You know, Deborah Jackson had, you know, it, she was missing for longer. So, you know, when they found her, you know, she was, you know, absolutely bloated. The similarities were, you know, basically the gun and how it was shot. It looked like the killer was driving and then using his right hand and, you know, basically reaching over to the passenger in the passenger seat and then shooting the person in the chest, because the wounds were almost exactly the same spot, like downward, you know, looking, you know, so it looked like it was somebody, you know, in a passenger side, sort of leaning over and having contact and then shooting.
Right.
If
now
that
you talk
makes
about
sense.
Certainly. You talk about this very, very interesting thing that haunts this entire investigation for years is January 10th, early 1987, and another alley and an anonymous call.
All right.
Tell us what the content of that call was.
Yeah. So what happened was Barbara Ware was killed on January 10th, 1987. And what happened was the LAPD dispatch got a call from somebody who basically was calling in that they saw a dead body or something in an alleyway. And the caller, a male, basically tells the dispatcher that, you know, somebody, they saw somebody like take the body out of a blue and white van, and actually gave the license plate number of the van, and said, you know, the person like dumped the body out and then, you know, put a gas tank on top of the person and then drove off. And so this was just after midnight. And so the LAPD, you know, went to the alleyway and actually found Barbara Ware underneath a gas tank, and there was like garbage thrown on top of her. And they actually traced the van with the license plate number to this Cosmopolitan church, which was on nearby Normandy, which wasn't like Normandy Avenue, which wasn't like actually that far away. And so they go to the scene and they found Barbara Ware actually had curlers in her hair, and they found a multicolored curler in the parking lot. And so they go there and they go to the church, and actually, which surprised them, they get there and it's after midnight or whatever. They realize that there's people actually in the church at the time. So they go into the church, and they also, the van was there. I forgot to mention the van was actually there. So they touch the van and they realize the van's warm and everything. So they think, okay, well, the killer, you know, drove the van, you know, parked it at the Cosmopolitan church and either went in the church or took off. So they end up knocking on the door, and there's like three women in there and a couple of kids, and they're having like a overnight slumber party. And this cosmopolitan church had these, you know, late night services, and some of the people actually lived, there were some family members, you know, that were kind of poor and lived actually at the church. And on that particular night, they were actually having a slumber party. And so the police ended up bringing them down to the station, and they actually thought there was like one kid who was like 21, 22, and another one that was 16. And they kind of honed in on the kids and did, you know, gunshot residue tests on their hands, you know, to see if, you know, one of them, you know, had killed Barbara Ware. And it ended up being, it was like a, it ended up being like a complete, like, red herring. And the police later learned, you know, decades later, when the LAPD started its 800 task force and, you know, eventually arresting Lonnie Franklin and everything, that it was Lonnie Franklin that actually made that call, which was, you know, very, you know, very interesting. You know, but it was a real, like, it really, you know, sent the detectives off in a different direction. And actually, when the detectives started the 800 task force, you know, they actually tracked down some of the cosmopolitan church members to try to find out if, you know, any of these guys were involved. And they actually went to Macon, Georgia, and there was a guy who was like a pastor, you know, one of the guys that was involved in the church, one of the ministers. They actually, he was buried in the front lawn of this other, like, pastor's home, and they actually, you know, took a sample. Like, they went in and they actually exhumed the body and took a sample and tested it with the crime scene evidence to see if he was the killer. And he wasn't. But, you know, so they went, you know, it was a real red herring, you know, to go down that route. And they still actually, the detectives actually never found out why Lonnie Franklin actually, you know, chose to give that, you know, like, you know, that license plate number. They still don't know, because, I mean, as far as they could tell, he wasn't a member of the church, and nor was his wife. So whether he ended up having a beef with somebody, you know, they don't know, or if he happened to just be driving by. But they don't believe that he actually took the van, because the the church member said that they had driven the van pretty much all night. But there was a period where they were praying and everything, but it wasn't during the time where, you know, the van was used, you know, in the murder of Barbara Ware. So it's a real puzzle even to this day, exactly why he chose the Cosmopolitan Church.
You talk about, you write about mid-January 1987, the Southside Slayer investigation had stalled, and there was talk about cutting back manpower on the task force. They had spent a lot of money, $95,000 a month on overtime, very expensive, all kinds of clues. Then you also had the pressure from the public, and especially, as you write about, Margaret Prescott, the Black Coalition fighting back serial murders. And then you talk about March 29, 1987, and another South Central woman found dead, and again shot with a 25 caliber pistol. Tell us a little bit about what they find and if they can progress in this investigation with this case.
No, I mean, it was the same, you know, it was the same thing, you know. I mean, they, you know, I think that the detectives were just, you know, and also too, I mean, some of the cases, they were all handled by, some detectives were handling the case and then it would move over. And by that point, it was the LAPD robbery homicide unit that had taken over the case. Once Barbara Ware was killed, the case was actually transferred over to robbery homicide, because they realized, well, they probably realized beforehand, but they realized that the cases were linked. And so a couple of other detectives from robbery homicide, which is like the elite, you know, unit of the LAPD that handles like serial killer cases and high profile cases, they actually took over the case. And so they started investigating the case, you know, but, you know, once again, you know, they, you know, had issues. And, you know, Margaret Prescott, I mean, she had press conferences all the time, you know. And I mean, it was interesting, because the police would give out, you know, as much information as, you know, I mean, they didn't give out a lot of information. They didn't want to give out, you know, what was going on in their investigation. And actually, it wasn't until much later that the press realized, and even then, like, it wasn't even like completely confirmed, really, that you know, Lonnie Franklin, like these 25 caliber killings were the work of a serial killer, you know, so they just had, you know, it didn't matter for them. I mean, it was just so difficult for them to solve it. So everything that they tried to do, it just didn't work out very well.
You also talk about this interesting pain in this entire story, this informant named Shelley Brown, again, July 6th, and she's crucial in this story, I guess, in putting it off the rails. July 6th, 1987, what does she tell police about Henrietta's killer?
Yeah, well, what happened with Shelley Brown was that Shelley, she was in trouble for another crime, and she had told the police that she had seen, she was at a hotel with this guy named Dennis Pinckney and another guy, they call him Pinky, and another guy named Let Loose. And they're at a motel room with a woman who she said was Henrietta Wright, and that they were partying, you know, doing coke and everything at this hotel room. She was in one room and Henrietta was allegedly in another room. And she said she heard a fight. She looks out the window. Henrietta Wright goes running out the, you know, running out of the door. The two guys end up chasing down Henrietta Wright. They jump her. You know, one of the guys shoots Henrietta Wright. She says she claims that she saw it. You know, they dragged her, you know, body, dumped it, and then took off and the whole bit. And so the cops, like, jumped on it, and they actually had a preliminary hearing. Like, Dennis Pinckney, he was actually arrested, and they had a preliminary hearing, which is basically a hearing where you show, the prosecutors will show evidence to see if there's enough evidence, basically, to take something to trial. And so they had this, and she actually testified. So Shelley Brown actually testified and said, yes, I saw him, and this is what happened, and all this other stuff. And so he was sitting in jail, you know, waiting for his trial. And then all of a sudden, she comes forward, like months later, and tells one of the robbery homicide detectives that she lied and that it wasn't, you know, Pinky. It was actually her other boyfriend, a guy named Jimmy Lewis. And so she said Jimmy Lewis basically told her to lie and to finger Pinky. And she did it because he had allegedly threatened her and that he was going to kill her and her family and everything like that. So then she completely changed her story and blamed it on Jimmy Lewis. And so the cops focused their attention on Jimmy Lewis. And so, you know, I mean, this happened on, you know, a few times, you know, in the investigation where, you know, people were saying, oh, it could be so-and-so. Like in the Bernina Sparks case, a woman came forward and said that she thought there was another guy who she saw, you know, fighting with Bernita Sparks on the night that she died. And so they focused on him, and it turned out he had nothing to do with it as well. So there was, you know, there was quite a few, you know, guys thrown in jail for at least, you know, temporarily and sometimes longer, you know, because they were fingered in these crimes that they didn't commit.
You move on to a woman named Lucretia Jefferson, and you just point out briefly about the difference in how they can handle cases like Karen Toshima, who was killed in Westwood, so a more upscale area by far, and there was an uproar. What was the media response to Lucretia Jefferson, which is demonstrative?
Well, I mean, there was no response. I mean, she was killed on the same day as Karen Toshima, and Karen Toshima was killed in Westwood by a gang member, and it was huge. I mean, the media was all over it. I mean, the politicians, I mean, the story went national, her death. You know, Westwood's a really ritzy area in, you know, Los Angeles, and, you know, you don't get a lot of crime. It's right by UCLA, and, you know, very rarely is there, you know, at the time anyway, very rarely, you know, any crime. It was mostly students around there, and Karen was walking with her boyfriend and got shot by, there was a fight between two gangs, and she ended up getting shot. And so it was just, you know, there was you know, a lot of money put into it. There was a lot of resources putting into it and all this other stuff. But, you know, Lucretia Jefferson died and, you know, it didn't make the news at all. And she was killed. Her body was found in South Los Angeles and actually L.A. County territory in Lenox. And it didn't make the news at all.
Let's talk about Alicia Monique, as she went by, Alexander. She's 18 years old. She was born in 1988. And you got to know her parents, Mary and Porter. And they were right following along and at the trial right to the very end almost. And anyway, let's talk about a little bit about Monique Alexander. And then after the witness that... the first witness that gets a look at the Grim Sleeper's vehicle.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Monique was like an 18-year-old girl. I mean, she was, you know, the love of her father's life. I mean, you know, he just doted on her. She was the youngest of the family, and Porter, her father, you know, he worked in the post office and her mother worked, and her mother had a couple children from a previous relationship, and she met Porter, and Porter was, you know, in the military, and they lived in South Los Angeles, and, you know, they were just a really good family, you know, and she had two brothers that just doted on her. Well, she's three brothers that doted on her and another older sister that doted on her. And she was excelled in school. She did really, really well. She was really into horseback riding. She was really into figure skating. And her father, like anything that she wanted to do, you know, the father put her into horseback riding. He actually owned horses himself, had her, you know, taking figure skating lessons. And she was this precocious, like really decent kid who loved people. And her parents would always say that she'd always bring friends home. And, you know, if they were having problems with their family, she'd ask her parents if they could stay over for the night. And so she was always feeding people and she loved everybody. And, you know, that was just sort of her personality. And just before she died, actually, she was dating this guy named Ronnie Lewis. And, you know, she was, you know, really madly in love with him. He was older. He was married and had a couple of kids, but was separated, you know, at the time. And, you know, she was hoping to have, you know, future with him. And I know, I mean, I spoke to him and he just still breaks down, you know, when he talks about her. I mean, he adored her. He just,
right.
You know, she was just this wonderful kid. And she started getting involved in drugs like about a year or so, you know, before she died. And, you know, even though, you know, she came from this, you know, good, you know, background and everything. And I mean, her father was trying to do everything in order to, you know, get her sort of away from, you know, that kind of life. But, you know, at the time it was just so unbelievably prevalent, you know, it was just, it affected everybody. And she fell victim to drugs. And on the night that she died, I mean, she saw her dad was like on the couch and she woke him up and told him she was going to the store and asked him if he wanted anything. And he said, no, you know, and so she left and she was, you know, last seen, she was at a store and one of the neighbors actually saw her getting into a orange colored Pinto. And the Pinto became pivotal because Mary Lowe, one of the other victims, was also seen getting into a orange Pinto. And Anitra Washington, the sole survivor, in 1988 in November, told police that her attacker was driving a orange Pinto. And Monique was found in September of 88, and Anitria was attacked November 88. And so that Pinto ended up becoming, you know, sort of, you know, a big piece of evidence, you know, for them to, you know, try to find out, you know, what, you know, who this person was and all this other stuff. And of course they never were able to find the Pinto and all that stuff. But there was definitely, you know, they made an effort to try to track down the Pinto, but they never, you know, were able to do it. But, you know, Monique went by, her family called her Moo and Moo Cow. And, you know, every day of the hearings. I mean, the hearings went on for 6 years after Lonnie was caught, and her parents went to every single one of them. You know, maybe they missed one if they weren't feeling well, but they were there the entire time from like the beginning to the end. And when I talked to Porter, when I found out about the case in 2006, you know, I interviewed him, and it was like, you know, Monique had died the day before. I mean, he blamed himself, and he was just, you know, he was just in tears. You know, it was like literally that she died the day before. He, you know, he never got over it, and, you know, he'll never get over what happened. It's really horrible.
Right. Christine, we're going to stop for just a moment to talk about our sponsor of the program tonight. Now, I received my movement watch, and I got the classic black gold. And this was after viewing Movement's impressive line of watches on their website. I was looking for a new watch. It was time for a new watch. I have an important wedding to go to September 17th, and I've got some really nice watches, but this, I was really impressed with the variety, the colors, the different watch bands, and just how new and unique a lot of these watches were. And I chose the classic black gold, and it is really classic, and it's a very simple design. They call it minimalistic, and anyway, just people have been asking me, where'd you get that? How much did you pay? So I know that they think it's a really expensive watch. It's a very impressive watch, and you got to go to their website and see about 150 watches between the men's and women's watches that they offer. Now, these movement watches start at just $95, and at a department store, you're looking at $400 to $500. Now, Movement figured out that by selling online, they were able to cut out the middleman and the retail markup and provide the best possible price. It's classic design, quality construction, and styled minimalism. Over 1 million watches sold in over 160 countries. Now, you can get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to mvmt.com/murder. Now, this watch has a really, like I said, a really clean, simple design. Seriously, I've been getting compliments ever since I put it on. Now is the time to step up your watch game. Go to mvmt.com/murder. Join the movement. Now, Christine, we were talking about Anitria, Washington, and it was this, they said that this was a big break for them to have this live victim that also saw the Orange Pinto, but also they learned quite a bit about his MO and his signature and a lot about the Grim Sleeper himself and how he operated. Tell us what they did find out, and especially interesting about the reference to the Polaroids.
Yeah, well, what happened was Anitria was walking down the street. She had just stopped at this little liquor store, and she noticed this Orange Pinto. And the Orange Pinto, you know, had like the racing stripe along the side of it and everything. And she was into cars, and so she kind of noticed it. And then all of a sudden, this guy's, you know, just says to her, like, hey, you know, and just says a few words to her, and she kind of ignores him. And she starts walking away, and he actually, you know, drives up to her and, you know, starts talking to her and, you know, basically, you know, tries to have like little bits of conversation with her or whatever. And, you know, she kind of ignored him or whatever. And then he kept on rambling on. And then she decided, you know, whatever, he seemed harmless enough. So she started, you know, talking to him. And then, you know, he asked her where she was going, and she was going to a party. And then, you know, he offered to give her a ride, and she, you know, said no. And finally, you know, she said, like, one of the things that stuck out to her was the fact that he seemed really harmless, you know, and she kind of thought he looked like he was dressed like in kind of a mechanic's outfit, you know, and then thought that, you know, he was kind of nerdy, you know, and he wasn't like a threat to her, you know, she didn't feel threatened in any way. Like, he seemed kind of, you know, just sort of, oh, shucks, you know, sure, I'll give you a ride, and, you know, can I hang out with you, you know, so she wasn't, like, afraid of him at all. And so you know, she didn't have to go very far. And so she thought, okay, he seems harmless enough or whatever. So she gets in the car with him and they start driving. And then he tells her that he wants to stop at his uncle's house, you know, to pick up some money, and it's on the way and whatever. So she was like, sure, whatever. And so he, you know, sort of pulls over. He goes to 81st and Western, just this house just on the corner, and pulls in, and she's in the car. And she basically said, you know, I'm only going to wait, you know, 5-10 minutes. And if he doesn't come back, she's going to get out and walk off. And so he goes off, and it's a white house. And then he goes to the side of the house and looks like he's talking to somebody. And then he comes back, you know, in 5 minutes later. And he drives off, and he only went, which is really interesting, because he only drove like about a block and then turned right. And she said that, you know, his demeanor had completely changed. He went from being like real friendly to all of a sudden being like really nasty. And then he called her the name Brenda, and he started saying like, you know, what are you dogging me for, Brenda? And she was like, what are you talking about? Like, my name's not Brenda. And, you know, he kept saying, you know, you're dogging me and all this other stuff. And, you know, she was trying to, like, explain, like, what are you talking? Apparently there was a prostitute by the name of Brenda that, you know, sort of walked the street, you know, the streets around that area. So she thought, actually, he might have mistook her for, you know, Brenda, the prostitute. And so she said that within, like, a second of them, you know, sort of arguing, that he just like pulled a gun out and he just shot her in the chest. And she didn't really, you know what was happening at first. And she said that when she finally kind of realized what was going on, like she started saying like, what's going on? Oh my God, you know, like you have to take me to the hospital. And he's like, you know, no, I'm not going to do it. And then she said she blacked out. And at one point she woke up and he was on top of her, like sexually assaulting her. And she said she passed out again and woke up to the zing, like of a Polaroid, and like the flash of a Polaroid. And he had taken a photo of her, and she sort of went in and out of consciousness. And then at one point she remembers him like pulling over and then, you know, getting out and like sort of pushing her out of the car and then driving off. And so, you know, she was able to, you know, tell police that, you know, this was sort of, you know, this is exactly what happened, that, you know, he was taking, you know, a photo of her. She didn't know how many, but she remembered distinctly that it was like a Polaroid camera. And so after she went, I mean, she was, she actually staggered like 4 or 5 blocks to her friend's house. Like how she was able to do that with a bullet to the chest, you know, God alone know, but she actually made it to her friend's house and like banged on the friend's door. And the friend actually wasn't home. And so she kind of fell into a fetal position, and the friend came home like hours later and found her there and ended up, you know, calling for an ambulance. And she was put into one of those pressure suits because she had lost so much blood and was like rushed to the hospital, and she almost died. Like she was like, you know, within, you know, seconds or minutes of dying or whatever. Once she was okay, you know, she was able to take the detectives to the place where, you know, he stopped, and he said he was stopping to, you know, see his uncle. And so they actually went to the house, but the house was owned by a guy named Otis White, like this older man. And so they knew that Otis White obviously wasn't the killer, because she described the guy as somebody in his 30s, sort of like a medium build, short hair, you know, with a pockmarked face. So she was able, you know, they were able to get more of a description, you know, of him. And then they knew, because of what happened with Monique, with the Orange Pinto, that, you know, this is the same guy. So they knew, you know, they were looking for a 30-year-old, you know, African-American guy with medium build with a pockmarked face, you know, who, you know, liked to use Polaroid cameras. So, but still, I mean, that was still like a needle in a haystack, you know, trying to track down, you know, somebody fitting that description. But, you know, they were certainly able to, you know, finally they actually had somebody who saw, you know, saw the killer. So, you know, unfortunately it didn't really, you know, didn't work out in the end until years later. But
you mentioned the police officer, Ricky Ross, from the L.A. County Sheriff's Office that was brought in here, and initially His gun, this 9mm, they said it was a match. But you also say that after the charges were dropped against Ross, after a thorough investigation, they basically, the murders, which would not even be attributed to the Grim Sleeper yet, the murder stopped. And so tell us how and when this entire case came back from the dead.
Well, after Nitria was attacked in November 1988, there were no other cases that were linked to, you know, the Grim Sleeper. And so basically throughout, you know, the end of the 80s and all through the 90s up until 2002, you know, there was no cases that were linked to him. And the detectives at the time, like, they moved on. One of them retired and another one, you know, just started working on other cases. And it really wasn't until, like, the LAPD started this cold case unit in the early 2000s to look at some of these old cases, you know, back dating back to, like, the 60s, you know. So they had this grant from the California Department of Justice to look at this old, you know, crime scene evidence in murder and rape cases. And so one of the detectives that was in the cold case unit actually remembered, you know, the series of murders that happened in the 80s, you know, the work of the Southside Slayer and the work of the 25 caliber killer. The Grim Sleeper actually was known as the 25 caliber killer back then. And so he ended up looking into the cases and, you know, started putting in the DNA, like getting the lab to, you know, looking at the evidence to see if there was any, you know, like rape kits or anything left, and then have those kits tested to see if there was any DNA. And if there was any DNA, they would upload it into the felon, you know, like the CODIS data bank, like the local, state, and then the felon, you know, data bank to see if the killer was actually in any of these data banks, which would mean that the killer had been in prison, because in these data banks, it's all, you know, everyone that's in there has committed felonies and are in prison, basically. And so he started doing that. And so he put in, you know, for this testing, and then all of a sudden, you know, he started getting all these hits, you know. So these cases, you know, Princess Bertha Mew and Valerie McCorvey were then linked to a number of the cases in the 80s. And not all the cases were linked through DNA, because some of the women were so badly decomposed that they weren't, there was no DNA. They knew they were linked because of the ballistic testing, but they weren't able to confirm a DNA match because of the fact that of the decomposition. So they started seeing that, you know, he started seeing, like, oh my God, you know, these cases, you know, are linked. And I mean, he knew about the ballistics matches and whatever. And so they started an investigation, you know, looking into it. And so, of course, the cases were uploaded into the data bank, because they were looking to find, you know, hoping that the killer was in jail or had been swabbed, you know, for his DNA in the past. But no, he wasn't. So they knew that the killer, it was the same killer, because he was leaving his saliva on most of the women's breasts. But they didn't have a name, because he wasn't in that felon data bank. So they, you know, they had that, you know, that was the big problem. So, you know, they had to, like, basically they started investigating, and they started looking back at, you know, getting the murder books, you know, back from the 80s and looking at all the suspects, and then surreptitiously, you know, like following around suspects trying to get DNA. And so, you know, that's what, you know, the detective, you know, that started working on the case was doing, because he went back and, you know, went back to, like, Jimmy Lewis, one of the suspects in the 80s, and went back and found out that, you know, some of the other suspects, like one of them had been in jail for was sentenced to 127 years and went in prison at the end of the 80s. So he obviously wasn't the killer. And then another one of the ones that they suspected, he was dead. He got killed in a shootout with a armed truck driver, you know, so they knew it wasn't him, you know. So he was combing through the murder books, you know, trying to find, you know, any witnesses or anyone, you know, any suspects that they could, you know, try to get a DNA swab from.
Yeah, you're talking about Detective Shepard, very, very tenacious and important to this case and to this story. You talk about also that in 2007, Janicia Peters, pregnant at 19, you talk quite a bit about her and her life, and she's found on New Year's Day in a dumpster. Tell us a little bit about what, again, is there a link, and what does Cliff Shepherd do with that information?
Well, what happened was Janicia Peters was killed on January 1st, 2007. And so the detectives had, you know, had known for a couple of years about this link, and all of a sudden the killer struck again. January 1st, 2007, Janicia Peters was found in a dumpster by a homeless guy looking for recyclables on New Year's Day, and she was in a plastic, a big, huge black plastic garbage bag, and, you know, tied up with a twist, you know, a twist tie in the whole nine yards. And the guy, he thought, you know, it was a can of, you know, a bunch of recyclables. So he actually made a hole in the bag, and, you know, a hand comes out of the bag, and, you know, he jumps out of the garbage dumpster and rushes off and calls the police. And so the police came and they found her, you know, they actually were able to, they brought the entire dumpster to the coroner's office, and, you know, she was, her body was processed and everything like that. And so they were, you know, the criminalists looked for DNA, and this incredibly smart criminalist actually swabbed the twist tie on the garbage bag. And so it was all put in, you know, like the DNA, and she was found nude in this garbage bag. And they actually thought that the killer had, you know, she either had taken a shower beforehand or he had washed her, because, you know, they didn't really find, you know, that much, you know, like DNA on her body. They found some, you know, DNA, but it wasn't like right on her body. So they ended up putting in for testing, and it comes back, the twist tie, the killer's DNA is found on the twist tie of the garbage bag. And so it was linked, that twist tie, and was found in May. It was actually at the end of April. They realized that the DNA that was found on the twist tie actually matched the killer, the Grim Sleeper killer. So at that point, the upper, like another detective found out about it, actually this guy named Dennis Kilcoyne. And so they all had, you know, like the LAPD brass, like they had this big discussion about, you know, what's going on and what happened and everything. And so they actually decided to start a task force, which they ended up calling the 800 task force. And that was after the name on the door, because they had room 800. So they called it the 800 task force. And so he had like eight detectives. Detective Kilcoyne was the guy in charge. He was a supervisor. So he had eight detectives, you know, working for him, looking for the killer. So that was like sort of the first time there was like this real big push to, you know, track down this killer. So it was a big moment then, you know, for them, you know, but, you know, they also had a lot of twists and turns and things like that, and also had issues trying to solve it.
Yes, they continue to have all these false leads when there's so much promise, and you capture that in the book too, that these, you also talk about the $500,000 reward that's issued here. So this case is getting an incredible, we haven't talked about, well, I mean, the obvious media attention to this, but also the three sketches of the Grim Sleeper based on Anitra Washington's description. Tell us a little bit about some of the initiative and the turnaround in terms of mindset from Kilcoyne as well.
Well, the LAPD at first, they wanted, well, Detective Kilcoyne wanted to keep the whole task force a secret, and they didn't want the public to know that they were looking into a serial killer. And, you know, I ended up, you know, I found out again that, you know, that Janicia Peters was killed. And so, you know, I wanted to write another story about it. And I, you know, really pushed to talk to the detectives and everything like that. And I finally was able to speak to Kilcoin about it, and you know, they, you know, he thought, what, you know, because most of the killings were happening in like a small area in South Los Angeles, that they didn't want to alert the community and scare other people and all this other stuff. And then they also didn't want the killer. They thought that if they announced that they were looking into it, the killer would go underground and all this other stuff. But I, you know, I just thought that it was important that the story be, you know, go out there. I mean, people should know that there's a serial killer out there, you know, especially in South Los Angeles, you know, a lot of people walking the streets, wandering around and things like that. But they had, you know, so at first, you know, they kind of wanted to keep it on the down low, but I ended up doing a story about it. And so once my story came out, there was a lot more, you know, coverage, and the LAPD started doing sort of press conferences and things like that. And they ended up getting a lot of clues and things like that. And so, you know, they were actually, at first, you know, they didn't want to do the press conferences. And then after, they were like constantly doing the press conferences, you know, to try to get more people to call, try to find more clues. And, you know, so, you know, they, God, there was thousands, if not, you know, well, yeah, I think like 1,000 or so clues. And so they went, you know, anyone, any clue they got, they would go and try to, you know, get a swab and the whole bit. So, you know, they really put in a lot of effort. And in 2008, in May, they actually tried this familial DNA test, which is, they knew,
right,
you know, the killer had his DNA, you know, they knew, you know, they knew he wasn't in the CODIS data bank. And so what they were trying to do was to find a relative of the killer who was in the data bank, you know, like a brother or an uncle or a cousin. So they actually did this familial DNA test, which is done by the California Department of Justice. And, you know, you have to apply for it. And the person, you know, it has to be a situation where, you know, like a serial killer situation where, you know, the public is at risk and everything like that. And so they decided to do this test, and but it came back nothing. And so, you know, there was no match to it. And they finally did it again in 2010, and the data bank had grown 400,000 by that point. And at that point, when they did the test, it hit on a 28-year-old Los Angeles resident named Christopher Franklin. And Christopher Franklin was too young to be the killer because he would have been in diapers when, you know, Deborah Jackson was killed. So they knew that Christopher Franklin was related to the killer. And so they ended up doing an investigation to try to figure out, you know, what relative of Christopher's it was. And they came across Lonnie Franklin Jr., who lived on 81st and Western, three doors down from Otis White's house. And he lived in the epicenter, basically, of where all the murders took place.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting that it was just blocks away and he was connected to every single one of these geographically, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, the kill site was, all of it was within 5 miles. And, you know, I mean, Mary Lowe went missing. And, you know, the bar where she went missing from was a couple of blocks away. Princess Berthamieu was found a few blocks away from his house. Lucretia Jefferson lived on the corner of 81st and Western in an apartment complex. You know, there was a lot of, you know, when they started putting the pieces together, there was a lot of connections there.
Now, they're looking at Lonnie Franklin. Surveillance is set up now. They have to get his DNA sample without him knowing. You talk about Paul Coulter with his extensive experience. He, I just found out how hard it is and how important it is to write up that warrant specifically and completely, and that's what he does, and he has a warrant ready for the results of the DNA. There's a little bit of a delay and everybody's on edge. But then you talk about Lonnie Franklin's background, as you find out. And he was born in L.A. in 1952. His mom was Ruby, and Lonnie Sr. was his father. Tell us a little bit about what you found out about Lonnie Franklin, and as everyone else finds out, but what did you find out about Lonnie Franklin and his background?
Lonnie came from a really good family. I mean, he grew up in South Los Angeles. He wasn't exactly the smartest student on the planet. You know, he had problems in school. His mother, you know, had a tutor for him and things like that. And, you know, but he, you know, he was a charmer. You know, he had a gift of gab. You know, everyone in the neighborhood liked him. You know, when I ended up interviewing some people in the neighborhood after he was caught, they all said, you know, Lonnie was great. You know, they knew, you know, he'd always fix things around the neighborhood. He was like the fixer-upper in the neighborhood. Like if you had an issue with your car, like if you needed new brakes, Lonnie would give you a really good deal, especially if you were a woman. You know, he was always helpful, and he was helpful to like older people. You know, if they had problems with, you know, getting something fixed, he'd do it for free. And, you know, one of his things, he was like obsessed with women. He had like this absolute unquenchable, you know, lust for women. And, you know, he had numerous, you know, girlfriends throughout his life. I mean, he married his wife, you know, back in the late 70s and carried on at least five relationships, you know, with different women over that period of time. Like when he got caught, he was, you know, a grandfather, you know, still married, living with his wife. And, you know, they had two kids and those kids had grandkids, you know, had kids, you know. And so, but he had these, you know, he just was obsessed with women. And there was some of his friends had talked about how he had nicknames for, you know, some of the girls, like Big Legs and, you know, all this other stuff. And he'd show his friends like photos of, you know, women, you know, like naked women. Like one guy actually testified and he said that, you know, a day didn't go by that Lonnie wasn't showing him like photos of like naked women and things like that. And he'd always address, you know, some of the girls, like they knew he liked picking up, you know, prostitutes and stuff like that. And, you know, he'd have, he'd always call them my girl. And, you know, sometimes he'd go around, even though, you know, he's married and all this other stuff, he'd go around with girls and they'd be hanging out with him and stuff. And he didn't seem to have any problem whatsoever and didn't feel, you know, showed them off and was happy about it. And, you know, one of his big things, like one of the detectives I talked to had told me that he thinks that Lonnie, like, you know, because I was asking him, like, what he thought about, you know, when Lonnie got involved in the murders and everything and what prompted it and things like that. And he had said that, you know, Lonnie was in the military. He left school after he got into a fight and joined the military. And he was like a cook when he was there. And he was out one night with a couple of his army buddies, and they actually tried to pick up a woman, a German woman, and they actually grabbed her and tried to force her in their car. But the woman was able to get away. But there was another woman who wasn't, her name was Ingrid, wasn't so lucky. And Ingrid was actually gang raped by, you know, Lonnie and the two army guys. And, you know, she actually was at the trial and talked about her encounter, you know, with Lonnie and the two guys. But it was interesting because, you know, Lonnie denied that he raped her and had basically said that she wanted him. And, you know, the only reason he was with her was because she was, you know, she told him how much she liked him and everything like that. And it came out like, you know, basically the woman, you know, they threatened her with a knife and everything like that. And she kind of just played along. And, you know, Lonnie was trying to convince everyone that he was the innocent one. And, you know, she wanted to have, you know, she wanted to be with him and all this other stuff. Meanwhile, you know, she had a knife to her throat. You know, so they think that his kind of his sexual, even he was pretty young at the time. He was like 21. And these other guys were more of the aggressors than Lonnie because they even said that Lonnie actually wasn't as aggressive as the other two. And so he actually got a lesser sentence. Like, and he didn't, all of them got tossed out of the military, but the other two got dishonorable discharges, but he didn't. And so he was actually able to come back to Los Angeles and, you know, get a job. I mean, he started off, you know, he did a number of different, you know, sort of jobs here and there, but he got a job at the LAPD Central Division as a gas station attendant. And he worked there for about a year and then actually got a job as a sanitation worker with the Department of Sanitation. And so he was driving trucks around in South Los Angeles. And I think that's where he actually got the intricate knowledge of like the alleyways and all that other stuff in Los Angeles, you know, and they found actually when they did a search on his home, they actually found photos of him, you know, at landfills and things like that. And I mean, he kept his job with the sanitation department for a number of years, but throughout, like, it was almost from the moment he started working there, he was complaining about on-duty injuries, like that he claimed that he had rotator cuff injuries, and, you know, he'd be evaluated, and some guys were like, no, we don't believe it, and other ones would be like, yes, you know, and it ended up that, like, at the end of the 80s, he ended up getting, like, a pension, and he went on disability, and when he got arrested, he was getting, like, $1,700 a month from the city of Los Angeles in pension, and he actually still gets it today, and he,
wow,
you know, probably gets around $2,000 a month.
Now, you talk about the arrest. It's not so eventful. Again, like a lot of these guys, he's doesn't put up a big fight or anything. He's pretty timid. Any confession? They're trying to get a confession. They employ some different strategies to try to reach him. What happens as a result?
Yeah,
any confession?
No. I mean, he didn't confess. I mean, they tried to get him to talk and... You know, the only thing that he seemed to get upset about, like, I mean, you know, they showed him photos of all the women and said, you know, do you know these women? And he said, no, didn't know them at all. And, you know, he even, like, kind of chuckled a few times. And at one point in time, he was, like, really disrespectful to a couple of the victims. One of the victims, he called her fat. And another one, he said she was butt ugly. And, you know, he was just, it was, you know, he just found it almost, he didn't seem to be bothered by it, you know, at all. And then he'd make these little wise cracks, you know, every once in a while. And the only time he seemed to be irritated, in my opinion, was when they brought up the fact that he was, you know, picking up girls on the street. Because at one point when they were following him, he left the house at like 2 o'clock in the morning, was on, you know, 40th and Western. And there was two girls, you know, streetwalkers on the side, and he pulled up. And so they were actually following him, so they saw what he was doing, and so they brought it up during the interrogation, and he denied it. And he was like, no, I have a girlfriend and all this other stuff. And so that was when he really was the only time, like, he really got miffed, was when, you know, they tried to accuse him of, you know, picking up girls on the street. And it was funny because during the trial, it was the same thing. Like, when they brought up his girlfriend at the time when he was arrested, and then he got irritated there too, and he was like, it's not my girlfriend. And it was like he was just more concerned about, like, his wife finding out that he had a girlfriend, and then his girlfriend finding out that,
sure,
he was picking up hookers.
You,
yeah, know,
he didn't
seem to be overly bothered. Pardon?
I'd say certainly psychopathic tendencies.
Oh, for sure. I mean, he didn't, you know, he didn't seem to be concerned at all about the women. And they, you know, said, look at, you know, you're not getting out. You're going to prison, you know. You're never going to, you know, walk the streets again. You're never going to fix another car again, you know, because he was also a mechanic. And they said, you know, just don't you want to give the families closure, you know? And he just, I didn't know them. I don't know them. And they talked to him for about 45 minutes or so before he finally just said, I guess I need an attorney. And
yeah.
So, you know, that was kind of that. And from what I can gather from what the detectives told me, because they listened in on his phone calls, like when he was in the LA jail, and he, you know, he denied everything when he talked to, like, friends, family, whatever, you know, it wasn't him. The cops set him up, and, you know, they'd ask him about, you know, how come you had so many photos? Because when, you know, the police caught him, they found, you know, they did a search of his home, and they found hundreds of photos of naked women and all this other stuff. And he claimed that, you know, was, you know, he fixed cars and they were left in the cars and he just had them and, you know, they weren't his. And, you know, he had, like, every sort of excuse in the book as to, you know, it was somebody else's fault.
Very interesting testimony from a man you mentioned named Ray Davis. And he was a friend from car racing, and he, Franklin had showed him bags of clothing and had talked about and done and had numerous conversations, and Ray Davis came forward. How effective was his testimony in sealing his fate, and how revealing was that information?
Well, I think it was interesting. I mean, I don't think it swayed the jury one way or the other, just you know, but I think it was an interesting insight into, you know, Lonnie's mind, because it really showed his compulsion and his, you know, that he was just so obsessed with women. I mean, it was just, he couldn't get enough, and he just couldn't help himself to brag about it. You know, that's all he did. And, you know, he'd always talk about it, and he, you know, and one of the things, actually, there was one thing that was actually kind of critical was Ray Davis remembered this one occasion where he saw Lonnie's van parked at a friend's house, and he saw Lonnie, you know, sort of outside of the van. So he pulled up, and, you know, Lonnie was all irritated, like, what are you doing here, kind of thing, or whatever. And so he went to talk to Lonnie, and he saw this girl in the back of the van, just saw her for a few minutes or whatever, and that was that. And he said, you know, as the years went by or whatever, you know, when they had these billboards up looking for the killer, the $500,000 reward, the billboards also had the photos of all the victims. And he had gone, he had seen the billboard, and then he was at the police station. They had sort of a smaller billboard in there, and he looked, and he realized that one of the girls, you know, was familiar. And he realized, you know, later, he kind of put two and two together, that the girl that was with Lonnie, he believed was Janisha Peters, which was his, you know, Lonnie's last known victim. And so he, you know, when Lonnie got arrested, he ended up talking to the police about it and said that, you know, he recognized, you know, Janisha from the neighborhood and remembered that she was the girl that was in Lonnie's car that time. But I think for the jury, the jurors, you know, the DNA evidence and the ballistic evidence was just so overwhelming. I think that, you know, that really, in a lot of ways, sealed the deal for them.
And there really was no, you talk about the defense with a desperate attempt to put it on somebody else and name somebody else, and again, a real tenuous, implausible sort of theory as to why Lonnie Franklin was innocent. And you talk about that it was for 10 women he was charged: Deborah Jackson, Henrietta Wright, Barbara Ware, Bernita Sparks, Mary Lowe, Laquisha Jefferson, Monique Alexander and Princess Berthamu, and Valerie McCorvey and Janisha Peters, 10 women. Was interesting. Tell us about what the verdict was. And then, as we mentioned, I thought it was very, very profound and very visual, was Ingrid W. 40 years later coming during the penalty phase.
Yeah, well, Lonnie was found, you know, guilty. I mean, the defense actually tried to, some of the women had other men's, you know, DNA on them. So the defense tried to say that, you know, how could they say it was Lonnie for sure when, you know, some of the women had other men's DNA. So maybe one of those men, you know, was the killer, but the prosecution
right.
was trying to say that the constant was Lonnie's DNA, you know, whereas it wasn't constant with the, you know, the other DNA found on some of the other women. It was all, you know, each woman had different DNA. But anyway, so Lonnie was found guilty, and they had the penalty phase. In California, they have the death penalty. And so they brought on the prosecution, actually presented four other cases that they believed that Lonnie was linked to, and so presented that evidence. There was two women had gone missing. They never found their bodies, but they were last known in the area of Lonnie's house, and they found their identification in Lonnie's home, along with Janisha Peters' photo and Anitria Washington's, the Polaroid of Anitria Washington. So they were pretty much convinced that those two women were victims. There was another victim in 84 who ended up being like sort of the very first victim, like that we know of anyway. This woman, Sharon Dismuke, she was killed in 1984, found in a gas station in a garbage, a dirty bathroom. And another victim, Georgia Mae Thomas, was killed in 2000. So the gap, the 13.5-year gap, was actually sort of, it wasn't as big, it was 10 years, but although detectives still think don't think that he stopped during that time. But also, so they presented test evidence that Lonnie was linked to those crimes, and also to one of the victims, Sharon Dismuke. The bullet that was found in her, it ended up that they found one gun in Lonnie's house, and the gun was used to kill Janisha and Sharon Dismuke. But for, you know, what choices that the prosecutions made, they didn't actually charge Lonnie for the cases, but they believed that he was responsible. So they also flew in Ingrid from Germany, and it was 40 years, and, you know, when she had been attacked by Lonnie. And so she flew in with her husband and actually testified to what happened. And it was very, she was scared, absolutely terrified, you know, and she had never been to the U.S. before and had basically, you know, kept what happened to her pretty much a secret. Her, you know, mother didn't really want her to talk about it. You know, she didn't, she later told her, you know, daughter and grandchild, but it's not a story that's known at all in Germany. And, you know, she didn't want to come at first, and then decided that she did want to, like, face, you know, Franklin and testified. And of course, he didn't look at her, and she kind of looked at him briefly. Her husband was sitting with her, you know, on the witness stand when she spoke. And it was just a really, like, just unbelievable moment that, you know, after so long she was there, and, you know, she was really, she was shaking, she had good reason to, for sure. So it was a real powerful moment. And so the penalty phase went on for, like, you know, for a few weeks. And at that point, the jury that found Lonnie guilty of, you know, convicted him of the murders, also found him, they basically said that he should get the death penalty, and they recommended the death penalty to the judge. And the judge actually sentenced him in August of last year, in 2016, to death. And so about 10 days after she sentenced him, he was taken to San Quentin death row, where he is currently until, you know, he dies.
Tell us about the reality of the death penalty in California, and also how it really delayed this case and many of the people, the loved ones that survived this. Well, I mean, went on after their loved ones died, couldn't even make the case because it had been so long.
Well, in California, there's a moratorium on the death penalty, and they haven't had an execution in close to 10 years. And in California, you have an appeals process. So even if you had the death penalty, it takes about 25 to 26 years for the case to go through the appeals process. And, these cases, they're looked at very closely. And so any case that's a death penalty case takes longer to prosecute. And the judges are very careful that the cases don't go back on appeal. And that was partly, you know, the reason why it took 6 years for them to actually try this case. And, you know, it ended up being like just an absolute, you know, incredibly frustrating for family members, because, you know, for a lot of them, it took 25 years before, you know, Lonnie Franklin was caught. And then, you know, they had to wait another 6 years before he finally went to trial. And, you know, during that time, you know, some of the family members passed away. And, you know, that was really upsetting for, you know, some of the mothers, you know, had died. And so they never, you know, were able to see, you know, justice for their, you know, for their family and for their daughter. And, so, you know, that was something that was really, really upsetting for, you know, the family members that would go, you know, every couple of days. And so, you know, it was dreadful for them to wait. And, you know, we thought that it wasn't going to, you know, it was going to take longer and longer. And I mean, some of the cases, there's one guy who's actually in jail right now, and it's almost been 10 years. It's a death penalty case. So, you know, they just take longer, you know, because the judges are just way more concerned about the case, you know, getting tossed out on appeal. So, you know, they give the defense attorneys more leeway to investigate and things like that. And, as a result, like, it just became like really a contentious thing. I mean, there was no love lost between the prosecution and the defense. There was, you know, a lot of bickering and a lot of issues, you know, going on there that, you know, stalled the case and things like that. So it wasn't, you know, it certainly wasn't a pleasant 6 years waiting for him to go to trial.
What was his demeanor and what was his behavior like at trial?
You know, his demeanor, you know, I mean, he went in, he never looked at the audience, you know, he never looked at the family members. He pretty much, you know, and he barely really talked to his defense attorneys ever, occasionally. He never laughed. He looked at a spot. It looked to me like he was looking at a spot on the wall, which was kind of right next to the judge, you know, Kathleen Kennedy, and he kind of fixated on it. I know that he, when, you know, they were putting up photos, autopsy photos and things like that, and, you know, one of the detectives told me I couldn't see where I was from where I was sitting, but he had said that, and so did actually one of the brothers, Monique Alexander, one of the brothers had said that they'd catch him, like, looking at photos, you know, like when the girl's photos, like, of the breasts and stuff like that, they'd catch him, like, you know, peeking over, you know, looking up at the screen and stuff like that. You know, but mostly he just sat there and stared. You know, he didn't, you know, he had no, it didn't seem like, you know, he had a care in the world, really. I mean, he must have been. I'm assuming he was, you know, scared, but he certainly, you know, didn't show it. And the only one time he seemed to be animated was when his girlfriend showed up one day and he looked up and saw her, and it must have, you know, obviously he knew she was going to be in the courtroom because he immediately, when he walked out, when they brought him out, he immediately looked up to this corner of the courtroom and looked at her. But besides that, I mean, you know, when he got the, when he was convicted, you know, when the, you know, in June, he didn't do anything. And, you know, he shook his, one of his legs, you know, he kind of twitched a little bit with one of his legs, but besides that, he just kind of got up and, you know, walked away. I didn't see him sleeping or anything like that, but he just didn't seem to be affected by it at all.
Mm-hmm. You have so much, in, like I said, talk about the incredible access you had to all kinds of players in this story. It's we don't have any more time, but it's interesting to tell the readers that about the interviews that you got from, and Anitria Washington, very, very interesting, and all of the dedicated detectives too, Shepard and Coulter and Kilcoyne, and in the end, Detective Dupree, a black detective that grew up in South Central, who was responsible at the end. Who, if people have heard of End of Watch, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, basically based around Detective Dupree's life, so very, very interesting. What is the most important thing that you took away from this? The biggest thing that you discovered in this lengthy investigation and book project?
Well, I mean, I just thought that the story needed to be told. I mean, it was just, there was a lot of twists and turns. I didn't, you know, when I first got involved in the case, I just didn't realize just how much, you know, attention was put on the case and just how much the detectives investigated and how much they were invested in the case as much as, you know, some of the, you know, as the family members. And it was really interesting scene because, I mean, there was no love lost between the family members and the police at first, you know, but towards the end, it was all, you know, like a big family, you know, the prosecutors and the detectives and the family members, you know. And when they got that guilty verdict, you know, I went out to the hallway and they were all hugging each other. And, you know, as much as they were all so different, they all had that same goal to, you know, find, you know, to have justice for the family members. And so it was like a really, it was, you know, obviously tragic, the situation, but it was really amazing just to see how everybody came together within this common goal to, you know, find justice. And it was really a wonderful thing to see because, you know, a lot of the detectives were from, you know, different backgrounds as the family members and as well as the prosecutors. And to know that they all came together to do this. And, you know, there was, it was really amazing, actually. And I was really proud to be able to witness that and to be able to get such incredible access to, you know, the case with the detectives and the prosecutors. And so, you know, I was really, you know, happy that they trusted me and allowed me, you know, access to them, and especially with the family members, because, you know, that was something that was still really, you know, difficult for them, and for them to, you know, talk to me about it, it was just, and tell their family, you know, their daughter's story. It was very, you know, overwhelming, and, you know, I was so happy they did that.
Yes, I want to congratulate you again on your very, very important role in this very, very incredible story and important story. I want to thank you very much, Christine Pelistek, for coming on and talking about The Grim Sleeper. For those that might want to get a copy of this and find out more about this, do you have a Facebook page, and maybe mention the publisher? And tell us just a little bit how people might contact you or find out more about your work.
Sure. I'm a writer. I'm a senior writer at People Magazine, and I also have a Facebook. I have a Facebook page, and I also have a website. It's ChristinePelisek.com, and there's a link there to Amazon, you know, if you're so inclined, if you want the book. And the book you can also get at, you know, Barnes & Noble and pretty much any bookstore, and, you know, also on Amazon, and I think Amazon and anywhere else, I think they sell books, you can actually get it, even in Canada too. So
absolutely.
If you go to, they have it in Chapters in Canada, and the other, I feel, Indigo.
Right. Absolutely.
So, yeah.
I want to thank you very much, Christine Pelisek, for coming on and talking about The Grim Sleeper. You have a great evening. Thank you once again for this interview.
Yeah, thank you very, very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And good night.
Okay, good night. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.